Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
This was originally broadcast in 2015.
Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory.
In the spring of 1906, a 7.8 magnitude earthquake set off a fire that engulfed San Francisco and reduced much of it to ashes. As that inferno bore down on the city's Chinatown neighborhood, there was no question what Lee Yok Sui had to save. It was the one possession that proved his U.S. citizenship, his birth certificate.
That birth certificate, you know, is so important to the Chinese. You always save everything. You have to save everything, or else, you know, when you, the immigration authorities will always question, you know, why you are here, why you as a Chinese person are here.
This is Connie Young Yu, Lee Yok Sui's granddaughter. At the time that Lee and hundreds of thousands of others fled their homes, the city by the bay was deeply divided. Its steep hills and sand dunes marked the boundaries of race, class, and ethnicity. Everyone knew their place. And for around 25,000 residents of Chinese origin, stepping out of bounds was especially dangerous.
The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 placed Chinese immigrants on the margins. Acts of racial terror were a daily threat. While Chinatown was a segregated ghetto, it provided its residents with 15 blocks of desperately needed refuge. The devastation the Great Fire of 1906 brought to Chinatown would change that reality. In surprising ways. Producer Chelsea Davis takes the story from here.
It was around 5 in the morning on April 18 when the ground began to shake under Lee Yok Sui, a shop owner in Chinatown. He glanced out his kitchen window to see houses collapsing and terrified people rushing through the streets. So Lee gathered his wife and newborn daughter, and together they fled the house. Calls of the Earth Dragon is stirring echoed around them as rumors spread of a fire heading for the neighborhood. Here's Lee's granddaughter again, Connie Young Yu.
It was chaotic. Probably he felt like he was in a war.
Yu says her grandfather put his family onto a wagon headed for the bay. Then he went back for that birth certificate. Lee quickly ducked into his store and rustled up what he needed. But as he emerged into the street again, Yu says, a white soldier caught sight of him and assumed he was a looter.
And the soldier stabs him with his bayonet, just like that. And my grandfather, he crumpled to the ground and he played dead. He just lay there.
Lee escaped with a flesh wound. But as his run-in with the soldier suggests, the fires engulfing the city that day left Chinese residents exposed to all kinds of social dangers as they fled through unfamiliar neighborhoods.
The built environment keeps everyone in their place. So if you're an elite white San Franciscan, you don't have to see the residents of Chinatown unless you go there.
This is Andrea Davies, a historian at the Stanford Humanities Center and herself a former firefighter in San Francisco.
And so with everything gone, they're watching all these people rush through the city. As the Chinese are leaving their homes in desperation, they're being yelled at to get out and don't turn back. I call it heightened post-disaster racism.
And according to Davies, it wasn't just private citizens. She says increased racism during a catastrophe can influence city officials' responses, too. Think of the soldier who mistook Lee Yok Sui for a looter, or the responders tasked with extinguishing the flames.
The fire department did very little to stop the fires in Chinatown and, in fact, made it worse. So if you look at Chinatown, which is nestled right against Nob Hill, where all the elite mansions are, all the water goes, directed by the mayor, to save Nob Hill. And all the dynamite goes into Chinatown.
Yeah, dynamite. It was a last-ditch effort to stop the fire from reaching the richest, whitest district. The effort failed, and thanks to the explosives, Chinatown burned all the faster. In the following days, as the embers of Chinatown cooled, the Chinese residents found themselves homeless and newly vulnerable in hostile streets. But things were about to get worse.
So many of the city's political and business leaders were actually excited about this social equalizing disaster because it eliminated Chinatown and they thought, we'll never rebuild it.
Many whites had seen the neighborhood as a Gomorrah of opium dens, prostitution, and disease. But Chinatown also occupied prime downtown real estate that the city's power brokers had long been eyeing. In 1904, 2 years before the fire, then-Mayor James Phelan had asked architect Daniel Burnham to draft some sketches of a new downtown. And in those sketches, there simply is no Chinatown.
And so the minute the city goes up in flames, I'm not kidding, I don't think the city's finished burning, and James Phelan is telegraphing Daniel Burnham, send more reports immediately, get them to the hands of the city leaders and business leaders. Here's the perfect city.
In the days after the fire, the current mayor, Eugene Schmitz, worked fast to make that perfect city a reality. He appointed James Phelan and other powerful leaders to a committee entirely dedicated to relocating Chinatown. The leading proposal punted Chinese residents to the outskirts of town, among the city's slaughterhouses. Davies says the beleaguered Chinese community soon caught wind of the plan.
And they fought back, and I think they fought back very intelligently.
The Chinese launched their self-defense on multiple fronts. First, they simply started rebuilding in Chinatown before others got there. One Chinese language newspaper, the Chung Sai Yat Po, made sure Chinese refugees knew their land rights.
According to U.S. laws, if the land belongs to the building owner, the landlord has the right to build on his land. Local officials have no right to stop him.
Even China's Empress Dowager, Cixi, got involved, sending her consul general from Washington to meet with San Francisco officials. But the most significant move was economic. For decades, San Francisco had been a key hub for lucrative trade with China. So a group of the city's top Chinese merchants wrote to Mayor Schmitz in a language city officials easily understood.
And so the negotiation was, okay, you don't want us to come back? We can go to Tacoma. We can go to Portland. So there's a panic of a loss of revenue for the city.
By May 10, less than a month after the fire, the mayor dissolved his committee to relocate Chinatown. Filmmaker Felicia Lowe says it was a political victory on an unprecedented scale.
They outsmarted and they outplayed the city fathers to fight fire with fire.
But the Chinese community took their victory one step further. San Francisco was a blank slate after the fire. So instead of letting the city draw up new architecture, an American-born Chinese merchant named Luk Tin Eli had a plan.
The word was, build me a pagoda.
Before the fire, Chinatown's architecture had blended in with the rest of San Francisco's Italianate buildings. But Luk Tin Eli's blueprint would make the rebuilt Chinatown into what he described as a new Oriental city.
He was able to pull together the resources and a committee of like-minded Chinese merchants to hire white architects to create a Chinatown that looked the way white people imagined Chinatown to look. Even though he knew in his own mind that the buildings in China didn't look like this.
The result was a Chinatown that Lowe calls a Disneyland vision of China. Pagoda-topped buildings, bright reds and golds, and dragon symbols everywhere. It used Western stereotypes to rake in tourist dollars and to give the district a new reputation for cleanliness and safety. Consider it a sort of architectural revenge. Today, Chinatown remains one of San Francisco's most visited neighborhoods. Of course, this makeover didn't change everything. Sinophobia persisted for decades, and Chinese immigrants couldn't even become naturalized citizens until 1943. But even the 1882 naturalization ban had a lot less bite after the fire, because there was one final ironic boon from the 1906 catastrophe that created an influx of immigrants.
The fire destroyed the city hall, which maintained all the vital records, birth, death, marriages. So what happened was that some of the Chinese went to city hall claiming that they were in fact citizens, and there was no way to disprove it.
On one level, many see Chinatown's story as grim. It took a natural disaster, a devastating fire, to give the Chinese a political voice in the city where they'd lived for more than 50 years. But Li Yok-sui, the merchant stabbed as he fled, refused to be bitter. If anything, his granddaughter says, the Great Fire and the fierce fight for Chinatown gave the Li family a greater sense of belonging in their country, the United States.
And they felt that somehow being in the earthquake and coming back made them part of the city, that they felt they had a stake in. Look, we were here. We were here and we survived.
Reporter Chelsea Davis brought us that story. We'll have a link on our website to Felicia Lowe's films about Chinatown and to Andrea Davies' book, Saving San Francisco, Relief and Recovery After the 1906 Disaster. Just head to backstoryradio.org.
That'll do it for us today. Thanks for joining me to take a look back at the Backstory Archive. There are hundreds of other shows available at our website, backstoryradio.org. You can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of an episode or ask us your question about history. Send us an email at backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Backstory Radio. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.